Among Ray's many honors,
he is the recipient of the $500,000 MIT Lummelson Prize, the world's largest relative to innovation. In 1999, he received the National Medal of Technology, the nation's highest honor in technology, from President Clinton in a White House ceremony. And in 2002, he was inducted into the nation's Invention Hall of Fame, created by the U.S. Patent Office. He has received 13 honorary doctorates and has been honored by 3 U.S. presidents. Ray has written 5 books, 4 of them becoming national bestsellers. The Age of Spiritual Machines has been translated into 9 languages and was the number 1 bestseller on Amazon in science. Ray's latest book, The Singularity is Near, was a New York Times bestseller and has been number 1 on Amazon in science and in philosophy. We're honored to have such an illustrious speaker here with us this morning. So let's give Ray Kurzweil a huge, terrific welcome.
I always look forward to speaking to groups about education and also information technology, particularly such large and enthusiastic groups as this. Those two fields are intersecting now, and there's a great transformation underway in education from being a sort of pre-information field to a post-information field. That's one that's really being transformed in terms of our ability to provide computer-assisted instruction and also to communicate. For example, my alma mater, MIT, which I'm on the board of, we now have a program that give away all our courses around the world. And you've got classes in Nigeria and Pakistan and China where kids gather around a computer and take an MIT course. We've got a facilitator, but basically they're taking MIT courses. About 70% of them are online now. It'll be 100% next year. They plan to put the actual lectures online as well, in terms of the video streaming. Berkeley's already actually done that. There's a great transformation underway in education. And one by one, each industry is being transformed by information technology. Another significant one is biology and medicine. That little $2 trillion industry is being transformed from a hit-or-miss affair, which has happened to find something. Oh, here's something that lowers blood pressure. We don't really know why this works. To a information technology where we can really reprogram the information processes underlying biology. And I'll come back and talk more about that, but that's going to transform our health. And also our education about learning about our physical bodies, because we're really learning how they work as information processes, and basically that is what biology is, since it's all based on DNA. And there's an important observation about any field of science or technology that becomes an information technology, which is that the power of information technologies doubles every year. I call that the law of accelerating returns. And you've probably heard of Moore's law, which says that the key features on integrated circuits shrink. You can put twice as many components on a chip every 2 years. They run faster because the components are smaller. But Moore's law is really just one example of many of this pervasive trend. And on the video, you heard reference of fact, well, you can't really tell the future. And, you know, personally, I don't know what I'm going to have for dinner tonight either. Specific projects are hard to predict, specific people, specific organizations. But one thing I've discovered is that the overall impact of information technology is very predictable in terms of price performance, capacity, bandwidth, of many different technologies in many different areas. We can make precise predictions about what will happen. And I say this now not just looking at past data and overfitting to that data, but I've been making these forward-looking predictions for several decades. I realized about 30 years ago that the key to being successful as an inventor was being able to predict the future, to be able to know when technology trends would arrive at certain sets of features that would make inventions feasible. Timing was the key. I now get a lot of business plans and technology proposals, and we do some mentoring and early stage funding. And I would say 95% of the projects that we get proposals for would do exactly what they say if given the resources. It's not the R&D department that fails when an invention fails. But 90% of those projects would still fail because the timing is wrong. Not all the enabling factors would be in place. So being an engineer, I began to gather a lot of data and tried to study this in a methodical way and develop some mathematical models and found that those models were really tracking very accurately. And I've now been doing this for 30 years. My first book, The Age of Intelligent Machines, which I wrote in the 1980s, had hundreds of predictions about the 1990s and early 2000 years. I just looked at it the other day. It's written 20 years ago, and it's really very close to the year, has been quite accurate. If anything, it's been conservative. For example, like I saw the ARPANET, Advanced Research Projects Agency, doubling in size every year, but it was only used by a few thousand scientists in the 1980s. So it went from 10,000 now to 20,000, and then 40,000. But doubling every year means multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years, and I felt that this would continue. This would be an inexorable trend. So it would be 10 million going to 20 million to 40 to 80 to 160 million in the mid-1990s. It would be a worldwide communication network tying together hundreds of millions of people around the world. That was considered a ridiculous prediction, actually. It was heavily criticized at the time. I predicted the World Wide Web would emerge in 95, 96. First reference to the World Wide Web was 93 in the New York Times. I saw the chess machines doubling in size every year, the chess supercomputers, which resulted in them adding 40 points to the chess score. So that put 1998 as a crossover point when a chess computer would defeat the world chess champion. Kasparov was actually asked about that in 93. And he said, that's ridiculous. I've played the best chess machines in the world, and they're pathetic. They're predictable. They're brittle. They'll never touch me. And that was true in 1993, but they soared past him in 97. And the power of exponential growth is seductive. When you double the little numbers, it looks like nothing is happening. And suddenly things explode, and new applications become feasible that seemed impossible just a little while ago. I mentioned biology, and the Genome Project itself was controversial in 1990. This is now a hallmark of science and is taught as one of the great landmarks in biology. But in 1990, this was not a mainstream project. This was kind of a renegade project. Mainstream skeptics said, there's no way you're going to sequence the genome in 15 years. We just had our best PhD students, our most advanced equipment around the world, and we managed to collect 1/10,000th of the genome. And halfway through the project, 7.5 years into the 15-year project, the skeptics were still going strong, saying, I told you this wasn't going to work. And here you are, 7.5 years in a 15-year project, and you finish 1% of the project. But if you double 1% seven more times, you get 100%, and that's exactly what's happened. And that's continued since the end of the Genome Project and with other aspects of biology, databases, proteome project, brain data, and so on. In fact, if we can measure the information content of an area, we generally find that it grows exponentially, with the doubling time being 12 months, 11 months, 13 months, depending on what you measure. And doubling every year is multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years, a billion in 30 years, and actually there's a slow second level of exponential growth, so it's really 25 years. The power of these technologies will expand by a billion. And look at how it's already quite significant. And that billion-fold comparison applies also looking backwards. It already has tremendous traction. It's already beginning to transform every business model. We're in the early stages of a transforming education and medicine and other fields. Imagine a billion-fold increase in the power of these technologies over the next quarter century, while at the same time we shrink the size of these technologies. It's another model, the key features of technology in both electronic and mechanical technologies and three-dimensional features. It's shrinking by a factor of 100 per decade. That's a factor of 100,000 in 25 years. And you get some idea of what will be feasible. So I brought an example of an educational technology, disabilities technology, which I've been involved in for 30 years. And then I'd like to show you a few dozen examples of these trends among the hundreds that we have, just to show you how pervasive this is, and then we can talk about some scenarios of what will be feasible. And if anything, the future will be more remarkable than what we can predict today, because we'll have all of you and your colleagues and companies around the world, millions of people applying their creative ideas to utilizing these new capabilities. So I've been involved in reading machine technology for 30 years.
The system is on. Camera is off. I'm ready.
So this is a print-to-speech reading machine. It's thousands of times smaller and lighter than the first print-to-speech reading machine, which was actually exactly 30 years ago, in 1976. And it's also a lot more powerful, a lot less expensive. And I've been giving, since I've been involved in reading machine technology for 30 years, I give speeches to disability groups. And so one of the things I've been predicting for many years is, will someday a blind person be able to take a reading machine out of their pocket and actually read print as you go through the day? The current standard before this came out was the Crystal 1000. It sits on your desk. It's a lot smaller than the first one, but you can't take it around with you. You have to bring printed material back to your desk. Well, you can't bring a sign on a wall back to your desk, the bank ATM display. You can bring a menu back to your desk, but you'd rather read it in a restaurant. I mean, just think how much reading material you read as you go through the day, handouts in a meeting, the back of a muffin box, tell you how to make the muffins, and so on. So in 2002, the National Federation of the Blind, with whom I have a close relationship because we worked together on the first reading machine, said, Ray, you've been talking about this pocket-sized reading machine for many years. When do you think it's going to be feasible? Says, well, according to our models, the requisite digital camera and pocket computer technology will be available in 4 years. I'd say May 2006, according to our models. Okay, Ray, how long do you think it would take to develop? Well, we have to do more than just put optical character recognition and speech synthesis software into the computer. We have to add a new layer of intelligent image processing, because the blind person's going to be holding it at an oblique angle. There's three different degrees of freedom of rotation, tilt. There could be uneven illumination. There could be shadows. The pages could be curved. I listed about 7 or 8 vagaries of real-world print that do not happen in a scanner, because the scanner has its own controlled illumination, and the documents are laid flat and square against the edge and so forth. So, okay, right, well, how long will that take? 4 years. Okay, well, let's get started. So we started in 2002, and the digital camera and the PDA technology came out right on time. The software development, actually, this was a surprise, was done on time also. So we introduced this in July, so that's about 3 months ago. We have on the order of 1,000 in the field, so 700 or 800. And so blind guys and gals are going around taking pictures of the labels in their clothing and having them read out loud, and the spines of CDs and the remainders of the bookstore, and handouts at meetings, and so on. So I'll give you a brief demonstration.
I'm ready. Camera is on. Camera is on. Field of view report. Top and right edges are visible, 30% filled. Taking picture.
The field of view report is actually pretty elaborate. You can just point it at a wall and it'll tell you where the print is. You're cutting off the right edge,
picture.
You should move to the right. So it helps you find text and
camera at 0 degrees clockwise relative to the page.
Just said it was 0 degrees.
Processing image, please wait.
So
page 1,
square, but
GNR 189. The AI winter is long since over, and we are well into the spring of narrow AI. Most of the examples above were research projects just 10 to 15 years ago. If all the AI systems in the world suddenly stopped functioning, our economic infrastructure would grind to a halt. Your bank would cease doing business. Most transportation would be crippled. Most communications would fail. This was not the case a decade ago. Of course, our AI systems are not smart enough yet to organize such a conspiracy. Strong AI. If you understand something in only one way, then you don't really understand it at all. This is because if something goes wrong, you get stuck with a thought that just sits in your mind with nowhere to go. Speaking cancelled. Camera is off. An unsafe thought, goodbye.
She's polite. She's actually pretty chatty. She's telling you what she's doing at all times. And as you can see, speech synthesis has gotten a lot better. So, and the passage I was reading is interesting also, because a lot of people ask me, whatever happened to artificial intelligence, because that's my field, that was supposed to be doing all these great things, unaware of the fact that artificial intelligence permeates our modern infrastructure. Reminds me, people are going to the rainforest and say, well, where are all these species that's supposed to be here when there's 50 species of ants within 25 feet of them? AI is deeply embedded in our economic infrastructure. Every time you send an email, connect a cell phone call, intelligent algorithms connect the information. You buy a product that is designed with intelligent computer assisted design programs, inventory levels controlled by just-in-time inventory systems, manufactured in robotic factories. Billions of dollars of financial transactions are placed automatically every day. I have one company that does that and places tens of millions of dollars every day of financial transactions unassisted. AI programs are flying and landing airplanes, guiding intelligent weapon systems, automatically diagnosing electrocardiograms and blood cell images, and I could list 100 other examples. And it's narrow AI because these programs are doing functions that used to require human intelligence, very often doing it at better levels, but thus they don't have the full range and suppleness of human intelligence, which is largely based on pattern recognition. That is what humans do better than machines. Although that's my field, pattern recognition, and machines are improving in their abilities. In fact, they're improving linearly as we make exponential gains in hardware and software. But ultimately, computers will get very close and match human intelligence. I'll come back to when that will happen and the implications in a few moments. But the narrowness of these AI applications is gradually getting less narrow. So let's take a few examples of how pervasive these exponential trends, how predictable they are, despite the vagaries of human history. Well, I'll keep talking while somebody fixes this. See, I'm stuck. This is not my computer. Where is the AV department? All right. Fixed it myself. You forget how to do these things when your companies get too big. So. A very interesting trend is that the paradigm shift rate, basically the rate of technical progress, the rate at which we change paradigms, is itself accelerating. I was at this conference a couple years ago on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA. And all of our speakers were asked, okay, what will the next 50 years bring? And every speaker there, except for one other gentleman, Bill Joy and myself, used the last 50 years as a model for the next 50 years. So Jim Watson himself, the co-discoverer of DNA, said, well, in 50 years we'll have drugs that enable you to eat as much as you want to remain slim. And I said, Jim, we've already done that in animals by blocking the fat insulin receptor gene in mice. That gene basically says, hold on to every calorie, because the next hunting season may not work out so well. By blocking that gene, these animals ate ravenously and remained slim, and it wasn't a fake slimness. They didn't get diabetes, they didn't get heart disease, they lived 20% longer, they got the benefits of caloric restriction while doing the opposite. Five pharmaceutical companies have noticed that, hey, that'd be a pretty good drug for the human market, and they're rushing to bring fat insulin receptor gene inhibitors to the human market, and this is in development. It'll be 5 to 10 years, not 50 years. All of the predictions were quite understated because they were extrapolating linearly, projecting linearly current rates of progress. And I think that's, I run into this time and time again. Just last week, I had a debate with someone doing brain reverse engineering. It said it took him 18 months to model this one ion channel, and there's four other ion channels in this dendrite, and this other dendrite has another six ion channels, and there's other nonlinearities, and he's multiplying it all out. Well, 18 months each, it'll be 100 years before we do this. As if there'll be no progress in the next 100 years in the supercomputers to model this and the scanning resolution of brain scanners, despite the fact that they double the resolution every year, and so on. I think it's hardwired that we tend to see what's in front of us and just assume that the current pace will continue at that rate. But the rate is actually accelerating. We're doubling the paradigm shift every decade. We'll make 32 times more progress in the next 50 years as we made in the last 50 years. And there's many examples of that. I'll give you just a few. Telephone, which was actually a virtual reality technology. You could be with someone else as if you're in the same space, despite being hundreds of miles away, at least as far as the auditory sense was concerned. And that was the first time that ever happened in human history. I mean, prior to the telephone, you had to be in the same room to have a conversation. And that is how they saw it. But that took half a century, 50 years, to be adopted by a mass audience defined as a quarter of the U.S. population. These graphs, in general, are logarithmic graphs. That means that you go up the graph, we're not adding to something being measured, we're multiplying by factors of 10. So with each level higher, it's a factor of 10 greater than the level below it. And a straight line on a logarithmic graph is exponential growth. But anyway, it took 50 years for mass adoption of the telephone. A cell phone did that in 7 years. If you look at these different communication technologies, telephone, radio, television, took decades to be adopted by mass audience. The PC, mobile phone, the web did that in a few years' time, and that has continued. We heard reference earlier to social networks. Well, that term wasn't used 3 years ago. 5 years ago, people didn't use search engines, so that sounds like ancient history. Imagine people living without search engines, but that was only 5 years ago. Blogs, that word wasn't used 3 years ago. 3 years ago, people were saying you can't make money in internet advertising. Now you've got one company with $12 billion a year of revenue in internet advertising worth over $100 billion that you probably use to search the web. And actually, while I think of it, that's a good example also of the democratization of the creation of knowledge, because you don't have to be a big corporation or a big educational institution or a government agency to create knowledge that's valuable. The kid in her dorm room with her PC and a little camera can create a quality motion picture, and there have been some real breakout hits, like Penguins, for example, that were done with just some passionate people and very inexpensive equipment. You can create a recorded album with just your PC. And a couple of kids at Stanford with their PCs in their dorm room wrote a big piece of software that is now that $100 billion valued company that I just mentioned. So the tools of creating knowledge are being democratized, which is basically fueling this explosion of knowledge that this educational industry and establishment needs to teach. The amount of knowledge is also growing exponentially, basically doubling every year, which is why we need search engines to keep track of it. And I have a whole theory of evolution. I don't know how well you can see this graph, but I won't dwell on this, but I discuss in the first few chapters of my latest book, Singularity is Near, that an evolutionary process inherently accelerates because it creates a capability, and then it uses that capability to evolve the next stage. So the next stage goes more quickly, and the products, the fruits of that next stage, grow exponentially in capability. This is a double log graph. On the x-axis, it's how many years ago this event took place, in powers of 10. And on the y-axis, it's how long it took for that paradigm shift to occur until the next paradigm shift. So the very first paradigm shift, basically the evolution of biology itself, of life, of DNA, so biology had an information backbone, a little computer system to keep track of its experiments, that took billions of years. Actually, RNA came first. But then evolution used DNA and has used it ever since. So the next stage, the Cambrian explosion, when all the body plants and the animals evolved, that went 100 times faster. That took 10 or 20 million years. And then the body plants became a mature technology, and evolution concentrated on higher cognitive functions. That only took a few million years. And then Our species, Homo sapiens, evolved in only a few hundred thousand years. It's actually only three simple genetic changes that distinguish us from our primate ancestors, and these changes comprise only a few tens of thousands of bytes of information in the genes. We're really very close to our primate cousins, and it's only a few tens of thousands of bytes of information that distinguish us. Basically, we have a larger skull at the expense of a weaker jaw, so don't get into a biting contest with another primate. More of that brain is devoted to the cerebral cortex. We have a much larger cerebral cortex, so we can do what-if experiments in our mind. We can do abstract thinking. We can do experiments like, gee, what if I took that stone and attached it to that stick with that twine? I could actually extend my leverage and create a tool. And then we have an opposable appendage, a thumb that enables us to actually carry out those experiments, change the environment, create tools, use those tools to create other tools, and have a whole evolutionary process involved with the creation of technology. And it might look like a chimpanzee's hand is similar to ours, but the pivot point is down 1 inch. Basically not a very good design. They don't have a power grip. They don't have fine motor coordination. They really can't create technology. You'll read about other animals using tools, but those tools don't evolve, and those tools aren't really shaped. They basically find a stake and poke it into an ant hole or something, but they can't really create technology. And then we always use the latest generation of technology to create the next technology. So 50 years ago, computers were designed pen on paper and wired with screwdrivers, and it took years. We now use computers, and 10th generation computer assisted design software design computers, and it takes a few hours. And you'll notice that this is a straight line on this double logarithmic graph, showing the continual acceleration, showing technological evolution emerging smoothly out of the biological evolution that led to the technology creating species. If we make the x-axis a linear scale, then it looks like everything has just happened. It's the nature of things getting faster. But people looked at this and said, well, okay, Kurzweil only put points on this graph that fit on the straight line. And if it didn't fit on the straight line, he didn't put them on there. So to address that concern, I took 14 different lists from 14 thinkers and reference works, Encyclopedia Britannica, American Museum of Natural History, Carl Sagan's Cosmic Calendar, and about a dozen other lists, as to what they thought the key events were in biological and or technological evolution. And there is some disagreement. Some people include the ARPANET with the internet, so it's 25 years, not 10 years. And some people think the Cambrian explosion took 25 million years and not 10 million years. There's disagreement when human language started. So you see some spreading of the points, but you see a very clear trend line. Things are clearly speeding up in a very linear fashion on a logarithmic graph, showing continual acceleration. Nobody thinks the internet took a million years to evolve. Nobody thinks the Cambrian explosion happened in 10 years. A billion years ago, not much happened in a million years. There's been a general acceleration. And we use simulations of evolution in the computer where we can simulate an evolutionary process by having different entities compete with each other in a simulated environment. And we use that technique in pattern recognition, and we can see the same phenomena of an evolutionary process accelerating. And information technologies are doubling their power every year, which is really phenomenal exponential growth. When I was at MIT, they had one computer, took up, I'd say, the size of this section, probably a little bit larger. It was cost $11 million. It's 1,000 times less powerful than the computer in your cell phone today. And I mentioned Moore's Law, and I mentioned that's really just one example of many, even within computation. And computation itself is only one example of this law of accelerating returns that applies broadly to information technology. So here I put 49 famous computers on a logarithmic graph that goes back over 100 years. In the lower left-hand corner is the first data processing equipment that automated an American census, the 1890 census. Used these old punch card machines, which were subsequently shipped to the Florida Election Commission. It's interesting that joke still works. We'll see how long that... It's hard to live down these reputations. In the 1940s, each stripe was a different paradigm, a whole different technology. They used telephone relays. Alan Turing cracked the German Enigma code using a telephone relay-based computer. It was actually the first computer. and gave an uninterrupted transcription of all the Nazi messages to Churchill and Roosevelt. A lot of interesting wartime literature as to how they used or didn't use that information on purpose, because they didn't want to tip off the enemy that they'd cracked the code. If they used it too readily, the Nazis would realize their code had been cracked. They did a lot of subterfuges to try to convince the enemy they got the information some other way. So if there was a convoy of ships, they'd send over a lone flyer. The German sailors would say, oh, we've been spotted, but actually that was just to make them think they were spotted, not the fact that the code was cracked. But in the Battle of Britain, the 3-1 outnumbered RAF used the information without reservation and enabled them to win that battle. They clearly would not have won it otherwise, and gave us a launching pad for a D-Day invasion. 1950s, they were using vacuum tubes and computers. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower, the first time the networks did that. And then they were shrinking vacuum tubes every year, making them smaller and smaller to keep this exponential growth of price performance going. And people say, well, you can't just extrapolate exponential growth forever. Exponentials don't go on forever. That's where Kurzweil goes wrong. He just takes these exponentials and projects them indefinitely into the future. And it's true. Each specific paradigm runs out of steam. They finally were shrinking the vacuum tubes, and they hit a wall. They couldn't shrink them anymore. And that was the end of the shrinking of vacuum tubes. But it was not the end of the exponential growth of the price performance of computing. It then went to another paradigm, transistors, which are not small tubes. It's a whole different approach. And that's what we've seen in every area of information technology. When one method runs out of steam for ongoing exponential growth, it leads to another paradigm to keep the exponential growth going. And as we can see the end of the line for a paradigm, it leads to research pressure to create the next paradigm. So we had transistors, and then now we've had several decades of integrated circuits, Moore's Law, and there have been predictions that that will come to an end. The first predictions were 2002. Intel now says 2022, but around 2020, the key features will be 4 nanometers in size, which is 20 carbon atoms, and we won't be able to shrink them anymore. And that will be the end of Moore's Law, but it won't be the end of this exponential growth of computing. We'll go into the 6th paradigm, which is the molecular computing in 3 dimensions. Chips are already nanotechnology, but they're flat. We live in a 3-dimensional world. We might as well use the 3rd dimension. Our brain is organized in 3 dimensions, but actually otherwise uses a very cumbersome and slow information processing method. It sends messages using chemical signals which travel a few 100 feet per second. That's 1,000,000 times slower than electronics. The computations take place in the inner neuronal connections at 200 calculations per second. That's 1,000,000 times slower than computers. But it's massively parallel. We have 100 trillion of them all processing at the same time. And it's organized in 3 dimensions. And we'll go into the 3rd dimension. Now that was actually a controversial notion in 1999 when my previous book on the subject, The Age of Spiritual Machines, came out. That it's really now a mainstream view. You talk to the scientists at Intel, they say, well, we already have 3-dimensional circuits working in the labs, they're self-organizing, we'll make the crossover in the teen years. My favorite has always been nanotubes. There's a nanotube-based memory actually set to hit the market next year. So that 6th paradigm will keep this going well into the 21st century. And now you might say, well, there must be some ultimate limit based on what we know about physics to be able to do computation with matter and energy. And yes, there are limits, but they're not very limiting. 1 cubic inch of nanotube circuitry at its limit would be millions of times more powerful than the human brain based on the most conservative estimates of the amount of computation required to simulate all several hundred regions of the brain. So the limits are not really something we need to worry about. You'll see that this is not a straight line. That's another exponential. That's that second level of exponential growth I talked about. It took 3 years to double the price performance of computing in 1900, 2 years in the middle, and we're now doubling it every year. And supercomputers marching along at an exponential rate. This chart from my book projects 2013 to reach 10 million billion calculations per second. That's significant because that's the most conservative estimate of the amount of computation required to simulate all several hundred regions of the brain. And I mentioned my predictions have generally been conservative because a few weeks after the book came out, Japan announced 2 supercomputer projects to hit that limit in 2010. And I don't want to dwell on these examples of electronics, but look at this graph. This is the cost of a transistor. When When I was growing up in New York, I would hang out at the surplus electronics shops on Canal Street, and they're still there. And I'd buy something about this big, which was one telephone relay with support circuitry, equivalent to one transistor, only a lot slower, and it cost about $40. 1968, you could buy a whole transistor faster than my relay for just a dollar. 2002, you could buy 10 million. Today, it's 100 million. Now, you've probably heard these fantastic comparisons of how far we've come in electronics, but what's really interesting about this graph is not just the extreme points, but look at how smooth the progression is. I mean, this looks like it's the output of some tabletop experiment, but this is the measure of millions of people's activity in thousands of companies and dozens of countries. We've had wars and recessions and accusations of one country dumping products in another and IPOs and bankruptcies. And you'd think that, okay, maybe there'd be a trend line, but the actual data would be very erratic. It's remarkable how smooth and predictable this trend is. You might, and this belies the common wisdom that we heard on the film earlier, you can't predict the future. Now you might wonder, well, how could this be? I mean, if each person, each company, each project is unpredictable, how can the overall result of all these many projects and people be predictable? Well, we see other examples in science of predictable results coming out of a chaotic system where each element is unpredictable and random. And the classic example actually comes from the 19th century, which is thermodynamics. If you have a gas, each particle is actually measured, is modeled as a random walk. You can't predict where a specific molecule will be at any point in the future. And you have this large system made up of a large number of random, chaotically interacting particles. The overall system is highly predictable, according to the laws of thermodynamics. They're called laws that predict that system to a very high degree of precision at points in the future. And technology evolution is just such a dynamic, chaotic system where the overall fruits of all this effort follow these very predictable trajectories. And unlike Gertrude Stein's roses, it's not the case that transistors are transistors. We've made them smaller, they're actually better because their electrons have less distance to travel, so they're faster, but smooth growth in speed. The cost of a transistor cycle has come down by half about every year. That's basically 50% deflation. And you can see that. Pick up a paper from a year ago and look at what you could buy a digital camera for. You can get the same specs today for half the money. And that's true in PDAs and computers. It also turns out to be true of databases like genomic data and brain data and software. And basically, in information technology, there's a 50% deflation rate. And the economists have started to worry about deflation, depending on what week it is. I think the Fed and Bernanke are back on inflation. But they'll tell you that deflation's bad, too. We had massive deflation in the Depression. And right now, information technology comprises a certain fraction of the economy. It's about 8 or 10%, but it's growing exponentially. It'll be most of the economy by the 2020s. And they'll say, well, it's maybe good for the consumer that you can get the same stuff, the same capability a year later for half the money. But if most of the economy is information technology and that has a 50% deflation rate, the economy is going to shrink. People will consume more, but they're not going to double their consumption to keep up with this doubling of price performance every year, year after year. So the overall economy, as it has to do with information technology, will shrink. And ultimately, that'll be just about all of the economy. But that's actually not what we're seeing. We actually see that we more than double our consumption. For the last 50 years, we've had 18% per year growth in information technology, despite the fact that you get twice as much capability each year for the same amount of money. Because as the price performance reaches certain levels, new applications open up and sort of explode on the horizon. People didn't buy iPods for $10,000, which is what it would have cost 10 years ago. So the internet wouldn't have been feasible. It cost us billions of dollars to collect the first genome. I gave a presentation 2 weeks ago to the directors of National Institutes of Health, and they're collecting 1 million genomes so that they can relate genes to disease states, and that certainly that wouldn't have been feasible when it cost $1 billion per genome. Within 18 months, it will cost $1,000 per genome. And magnetic data storage, I just put this up, it's another example. People don't talk about a Moore's law for magnetic storage, but we see the same phenomenon. It's a very pervasive phenomenon, anything having to do with information. And I mentioned how revolutionary the biotechnology revolution is. really reprogramming biology at a very fundamental level. We can turn genes off. RNA interference can turn off specific genes, like the fat insulin receptor gene, or genes that promote cancer and heart disease, or certain genes that are necessary for heart disease to progress, and we can turn them off. There's over 1,000 drug developments using RNAi. I just got the Nobel Prize last week. There are new methods to add new genes. The gene therapy's been around for a long time, but sending in genes through viral vectors is not an ideal technology. There's some new approaches that really put the information in the right place at the right time. I'm involved with one company that's actually cured pulmonary hypertension, a fatal disease. It's been proven in animal models. It's not going into human testing, with basically adding a new gene to people's genetic code that overcomes that disease. We can also turn on and off enzymes. Pfizer's tosentropin turns off one specific enzyme at one specific stage of atherosclerosis. The phase 2 trials showed that it stopped atherosclerosis. They're spending a record $1 billion on the phase 3 trials, showing their confidence in that disease, in that drug. And there are thousands of these developments. People have very often a negative attitude towards drugs on the market, which is very often well justified, but they were all done the old way, drug discovery. Just happen to find something that works without a really good model and understanding of why it works, and invariably it's had lots of side effects. The new paradigm is to actually rationally design these drugs to very specifically intervene in very precise ways. It doesn't mean they don't need to be tested, and there won't be side effects, but it's a much more powerful methodology. And the key insight is that the technology to do this, to simulate biological processes on supercomputers, the genetic data, the proteomic data, all of this is building up exponentially, doubling every year. So we went from $10 per base pair to, in 1990, 2 cents in 2004, it's a penny today, it's run away to a $1,000 genome. This slope represents a smooth doubling of genetic data every year. I mean, look how smooth this progression is. It's really remarkable how predictable these trends are. And I've been basing my predictions for a quarter century on these trends, which have held up. Communication, which is very relevant to education, is doubling. And I don't want to dwell on the technical measures. There's 100 different ways to measure this. But we really are approaching a deeply interconnected world with the sharing of cultures and information, creating social networks around the world, MIT and Berkeley and quite a few other universities are putting their courseware, and as a new phenomenon, Berkeley has led the way on this, and actually putting webcasts and archives of actual lectures, so you can get all the materials, including the lectures, for free around the world, and there are already hundreds of thousands of students around the world taking advantage of this, and this is going to gear up gradually. This kind of virtual attendance is going to become more and more realistic. It's not equivalent to real reality today, but it will become that way. I actually have a pretty interesting technology where I can appear virtually at a venue. I can't walk around like this. I have to be behind a special podium. But I'm life-size. I look three-dimensional. I'm full resolution. It's really quite, as I move around, the audience sees a local background behind me. And people, I've been convinced, I mean, they. One guy recently came up with a question on a piece of paper to hand me. But that's expensive technology today. Ultimately, that would be very inexpensive. We'll be able to attend virtually classes, and it'll be really just as good as being there. And you'll be connected with all kinds of computer information that assists the lecture process. We're going to move in general from aggregating people in auditoriums and buildings in order for them to share information. And the whole technology of cities and buildings and classrooms, that is a technology that enables people to communicate. We have this exponential growth of communication technologies, increasingly realistic virtual reality environments where we can do the same thing in virtual spaces. And if that sounds very daunting, I mean, 10 years ago I gave a presentation at the American Library Association saying, you know, in 10 years from now, This conference catalog is not going to be talking about book collections and card catalogs. It's going to be talking about database tools and search methods. And they thought that was, okay, maybe 50 years from now. And I talked there last year, and that is exactly what has happened. So education is going to move increasingly to virtual environments for the sharing of knowledge. Here's that little bit of the graph I had of the internet. I had the left part of it in the mid-1980s. It was then called the DARPANET. And I saw it doubling every year. So I made a prediction of this World Wide Web emerging in the mid-1990s. If you look at the same data on a linear graph, it looks like this. And we live in a linear world. This is how we experience technology. To the casual observer, the World Wide Web came out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. But if you looked at this exponential progression, which you can see on a logarithmic graph, you can see it coming. And with the increasing pace of change, we should see these things coming and plan for them. I mentioned we're shrinking technology at an exponential rate, factor of 100 per 3D volume. These are illustrations which have now been simulated from Eric Drexler's book 20 years ago, 1986. He founded the nanotechnology field. And this is being applied actually already to biology. There's four major conferences on BioMEMS, creating blood cell-sized devices that perform therapeutic functions inside the bloodstream. So if that sounds very futuristic, it's already being done in animals. One scientist, CureTech, won diabetes in rats. Scientists at MIT created a blood cell-sized device that goes through five elaborate steps. It detects the antigen specific to cancer cells, latches onto the cell, burrows inside the cell wall, detects that it's inside the cell, and then releases toxins. And it does all of this, blood cell-sized, it works. It's undergoing animal trials. And if you imagine now what we can do today and apply this billion-fold increase in capability over the next 25 years and 100,000-fold shrinking of technology, you get some idea of how sophisticated these devices inside the human body will be. You're looking at a robotic red blood cell, which basically emulates a biological red blood cell. That is an area of biology we've reverse engineered. And it shows an interesting observation about biology, which is, whereas biology is very intricate, it's also very suboptimal. Once we understand how it works, we can re-engineer it to be thousands of times more capable. A conservative analysis of these erythrocytes, robotic red blood cells, is if you replace 10% of your biological red blood cells with these robotic versions, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath, or sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. Honey, I'm in the pool, we'll take on a whole new meaning. And it'll be interesting to see what we do in our athletic contests. You might say, well, of course we'll ban them, but then you'll have the specter of high school kids routinely outperforming the Olympic athletes because they won't avoid them. And it's not at all clear we should ban them. We should ban steroids. Why? Because they're bad for your health. And if we don't ban them, then in order to be competitive, you'd have to take them. So you'd have to take something that's bad for your health. But these are good for your health. This would enable you to better oxygenate your tissues, and they would have anti-aging properties and so on. So we're unlikely to ban them. So, if we look back at the 49 computers I showed you earlier in the 20th century, projected in the 21st century, we see we'll have plenty of computation, enough computation, 10 to the 16th calculations per second, 10 million billion calculations per second will cost $1,000 in 2020. That's really a mainstream view today that, oh yes, we'll have plenty of computation to simulate the human brain, but what about the software? And ultimately, the source of understanding how the human intelligence works is going to come from examining human intelligence itself, examining the human brain. And it's not hidden from us. But actually, it was pretty much hidden from us just a few years ago. You've seen fMRI images, but that's not really good enough to reverse engineer the brain. So, okay, somebody's solving logic puzzles, you see that this area of the brain lights up, so you know that that has something to do with what that person's doing. That doesn't tell you how to actually reverse engineer it. An electrical engineer would say, no, I need to go in and put individual probes and individual signals. Well, we can actually now do that. We're doubling the spatial resolution of brain scanning every year. And we're actually able, I described six new scanning technologies in the book, for example, from the University of Pennsylvania, a scanning technology of scanning the brain in vivo, a living brain. You can actually see individual interneuron connections, see them signaling in real time. And we're actually getting the data and able to see the brain create our thoughts. And seeing clear evidence that our thoughts create our brain is because there is that feedback loop, there's that plasticity. If you actually study, let's say, the violin, you're creating new neural connections that reflect that knowledge and that capability. But then the question comes up, can we understand this information? Maybe it's just too complicated for us to understand. Doug Hofstadter has said for years, well, probably our brain is just below that threshold necessary to understand our brain. And if we were smarter and able to understand it, well, then necessarily our brain would be that much more complicated that we'd never catch up with it. And maybe there's a mathematical theorem here, that a complex system can't be so complex as to understand its own complexity. But that is not what we're finding. We're finding as we get enough data for specific regions, we can model them quite precisely with mathematical models as to how the information is represented and transformed and communicated to other regions, and then simulate those regions. You're looking at a block diagram of 12 regions of the auditory cortex, which have been modeled and simulated, and then sophisticated psychoacoustic tests applied to the simulation, they get very similar results as applying those same tests to human auditory perception. It doesn't prove that the model is perfect, but it does show it's pretty good. Another area of the brain that's important that's been modeled and simulated is the cerebellum. That's where we do our skill formation. It comprises more than half the neurons in the brain. And this has been modeled and simulated and tested. Very interesting model simulation of the early processing of the visual cortex. It turns out that the early visual cortex reduces these millions of bits a second that come from our eyes to 7 very low resolution movies. One just looks for edges, and another looks for other types of features, and sends these very, very sparse signals, and that's all the rest of the brain ever sees. So when we think we're seeing something, we reside in the rest of our brain, and we actually don't get that data. We basically hallucinate the world from these very sparse signals that we get, and pulling up memories of things we've seen before. It's very, very interesting observations. Now, it brings up an interesting question, which is how complicated is the brain? Well, if I show you a mature brain, it looks very complicated. I've estimated it would take thousands of trillions of bytes to characterize the state of all the ion channels and neurotransmitters in a mature brain. I take the cerebellum. If I showed you, I said, well, here, I want you to reverse engineer the cerebellum, and here it is. And you look at it, there's trillions of connections here, and they're all convoluted, and we'll never be able to figure this out. Well, we have figured it out, and it's actually not that complicated. There's only a few genes that control the wiring of the cerebellum with only a few tens of thousands of bytes of information. Now, how can that be? Well, look at this image here. I mean, this looks very complicated. And if I ask you how much complexity is represented here, well, the image itself takes millions of bytes of information. In fact, this is on the picture of a book called Complexity. And as you zoom in on an area, you see complexity within complexity. It's the Mandelbrot set. But the design of the Mandelbrot set is only 6 letters long. It's an iterative fractal that's applied iteratively and expands in apparent complexity as it's applied. That's exactly how the genome relates to the brain. In the cerebellum, I'll give you a summary of what the genome says about the cerebellum. It says it's 4 different types of neurons. One module is organized kind of like this. That's a couple of genes describe that. Okay, now repeat that 10 billion times and add some random variation within each repetition within the following constraints. That's a summary of what the genome says about the cerebellum. There's only a few genes that describe this whole process. And then you have this largely randomly wired cerebellum that then interacts with the world, and the child learns to walk and to talk and to catch a fly ball, and it gets filled up with meaningful information because it's a self-organizing system. That's really the beauty of its design. The design information of the brain is a billion times simpler than the apparent complexity that we see in an actual brain. Now, how do we know that? Well, we know that the design of the brain is in the genome. The design of the brain and the body are in the genome. And the genome doesn't have that much information in it. There's 3 billion rungs, that's 6 billion bits, which is 800 million bytes. It's replete with redundancies. One sequence is called ALU, which is a lengthy sequence, is repeated 300,000 times. So you can apply lossless data compression and compress the genome without any loss of information to 30 to 50 million bytes. That's less than Microsoft Word. And that is the design of the body and brain. And that then gets expanded into this very complex self-organizing structure that then actually absorbs a billion times more information than was represented in the design. And my point is not that the brain is simple, but that it's a level of complexity that we can understand. And I make the case in chapter 4 that we will succeed in modeling all several hundred regions within 20 years. And that'll provide the models for intelligent systems. It'll also provide greater insights into ourselves, how our brain works, how we learn, provide better strategies for computer-assisted instruction, and so on. And all of this is fueling economic growth. I don't want to dwell on this, but productivity has gone up. Adoption of these technologies has gone up. Here's e-commerce. It's now $1 trillion. And this was considered a bust just a while ago. Well, actually, it's interesting. You might say, wait a second, where's the boom and the bust that we saw in these dot-coms on this graph? That was not a mainstream phenomenon. That was a Wall Street phenomenon. Wall Street looked at the internet and said, wow, this is going to change everything. This is going to change every business model, which was an accurate perception. And it's going to do so exponentially. But exponentially doesn't mean instantly. If you remember my internet graph, that was growing exponentially, but it looked like nothing was happening for about 10 years till it exploded. And the same thing was happening with e-commerce. So Wall Street came back 3 years later and said, it didn't change everything, did it? And so all the values went the other way. I guess we were wrong. But meanwhile, e-commerce was expanding exponentially. And now we do have companies worth tens and hundreds of billions of dollars that are doing e-commerce. And in fact, that boom-bust psychology is an accurate harbinger of true revolutions. It happened in telecommunications, it happened in AI, it happened in the railroads in the 19th century. And we actually, if you take a broad picture, it's always an important political issue at a very local level, and you look at 1 or 2 years, but if you go back, you know, in the order of a century, we see very dramatic growth in education. Because we have been automating jobs and eliminating jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder. And the reason the Luddites were incorrect in their perception, I mean, they saw these spinning machines and clothing automation machines, where one person could do the work of 12, and they said, pretty soon there'll be no employment. It'll just be employment of an elite. But we created new jobs at the top of the skill ladder. In fact, we have many more jobs today than we had 100 years ago, and they pay 6 times as much in constant dollars. But we're adding them up here and eliminating them down here. So the skill ladder is moving up. There's been much more emphasis on education. We had 50,000 college students in 1870. It's 6 or 7 million today. And all levels of education have grown substantially in investment. So let me show you one more example of a technology I put together which will facilitate education and sharing of knowledge in the years ahead, and then just draw a few conclusions and scenarios that will be feasible with these exponentially expanding technologies as we go forward over the next several decades. I was involved with the first speech recognition. We created the first large vocabulary speech recognition system. So it took a contemporary version of our technology. We created the first speech recognition in the large vocabulary speech recognition in the 80s. We created the first text-to-speech synthesis in the 70s, took a contemporary version of that, which has gotten a lot more natural, particularly with emphasis on intonation that you could hear from the reading machine demo, and added language translation, which is also benefiting from these exponentially expanding databases. We can now take Rosetta Stone text, where we have the same text in two different languages, and actually use pattern recognition systems to actually automatically find the rules. So for example, Google, there a few months ago, showed me an English to Arabic and Arabic to English translator that they had developed, which not only won the DARPA competition, but equaled professional human translators, which they created from these very large Rosetta Stone texts, and nobody on the human team that created the system knew spoke a word of Arabic. So we can apply pattern recognition to these very large databases. And I put together a translating telephone, and I've used this to speak to people around the world. I spoke to this woman in Germany, I spoke English, she heard me in German, she spoke German, I heard her in English. We were able to communicate just fine. Of course, people misunderstand each other, even if they speak the same language. But this will be a routine service of your cell phone early in the next decade.
This is a demonstration. habe.
Dies ist eine Demonstration.
Of a prototype. Of a quote translating end quote telephone. Period.
Von einem Prototyp eines übersetzenden Telefons.
Within a few years, comma.
Innerhalb einiger Jahre.
We will be able to talk to anyone, comma.
Wir werden fähig sein, zu jemandem zu reden.
Regardless of their language. Period.
Ohne Rücksicht auf ihre Sprache.
The rain in Spain, comma.
La pluie en Espagne
stays mainly in the plain. Period.
Reste dans la plaine principalement.
Merci pour votre attention. Period.
Thank you for your attention.
Excuse my pen. So, we've only got a few minutes left, so let me summarize with a few implications of all these trends, but I hope I've given you a taste of just how pervasive these exponential trends are, particularly as fields, most notably education, but also medicine and other areas, are transforming from hit or miss affairs where we happen to develop something to where we can actually use exponentially expanding information technology. By 2010, early in the next decades, computers will begin to disappear. They won't be these rectangular objects we carry around. They started out as very formidable machines, they're already quite small. They're already starting to disappear. People complain they can't find their nano iPods. I have my whole photo collection and movie collection on a 4 gigabyte flash card. That is the size of a fingernail, and I have lost it. So computers are getting smaller. They will begin to be embedded everywhere. They'll be computing everywhere, in the environment, in our clothing. I'm in fact working on one project called Sensory Apparel for Life, which will be an intelligent undergarment that detects your health functions. It does a full morphology EKG. It Bluetooths to your cell phone. So it can tell you, particularly for our heart patients, as they exercise, tell you good news, your atrial fibrillation is getting better, or have you filled out your will lately? Send an EKG strip to your doctor and so on. But we will have computing everywhere in our clothing. We'll be online all the time with high-speed wireless internet connection. But what about displays? We have this dilemma. People like large screen displays. People spend thousands of dollars for 5-foot high-definition screens. At the same time, we like our devices to be small, even smaller than this. But that doesn't leave room for a very large screen. I mean, people are watching movies and television shows on their iPods. It's not a very satisfactory experience. The answer is to put them in the eyeglasses and have the images beamed directly to your retina. You can create a virtual screen that hovers in the air, or it can take over your whole visual field of view and create full immersion virtual reality or augmented reality. There are already cars that are being developed, that are, their prototypes exist, where instead of the navigation system being on a little display over here, it's actually embedded with augmented reality, it will show you right on the road where you should go. Well, that'll ultimately be built into our eyeglasses. You can look at someone, will remind you it's their birthday next Tuesday. Remind you what their name is, that'll be very helpful. we'll have full immersion virtual reality that can take over our whole visual field of view and share information. That's particularly important for education, because when we get together educationally, basically, it's visual and auditory communication, and that really will be full immersion, pretty much equivalent to being at the lecture early in the next decade, and it will get more and more realistic until any subtle differences will ultimately go away. And we'll have effective language translation, we'll be interacting with virtual personalities to conduct routine transactions. This is a graph I had in my 1999 book. I don't know how well you can read it, but it's a furtive human race writing out defensively reasons why computers will never be able to do one task or another. The items on the wall were still ones that held up in 1999. I reran this in my 2006 book, but put dotted lines around the tasks that I felt would fall off the wall soon. I was at a conference with George Gillard this fall, and he challenged me on one of them, which is only humans can drive cars. It's one of the signs up there. And he said, well, you know, we just had this DARPA competition where these computers were driving the cars themselves, and they're supposed to do this 300-mile, very complex route, and they all ran off the road in a very short period of time. It's going to be decades before computers can successfully drive cars. I said, well, I've been following that research. Very often it's darkness before the dawn. There were little bugs in these different systems. I believe the next time they run this competition, or if not that time, the time after it, a car will succeed in completing the route. Well, a few weeks later, DARPA re-ran the competition. Five cars completed this very complex 300-mile route with all kinds of obstacles and going up circuitous mountain routes and so on. And they're now gearing up actually to do this in urban traffic. So you might want to be careful for a few weeks. But if we go on to 2029, we'll have actually 30 doublings of price performance, capacity, bandwidth, and information technology. It's a billion-fold increase. If you consider what's feasible already today, that's a pretty dramatic comparison. 100,000-fold shrinking, as I mentioned. We will have models of all the different regions of the brain that will expand our artificial intelligence toolkit to create more and more intelligent computer systems. We'll also have greater insight into ourselves, including our emotional lives. We'll have better understanding than the vague models we have today. What's going on in the mind of someone that's bipolar or schizophrenic? We'll understand that and have better tools for dealing with these issues. But it's not an alien invasion of intelligent machines to compete with us. It's emerging from within our civilization, and it's expanding our mental horizons. It's already doing that. We routinely do intellectual feats that would be impossible without our computers. Recent theorems have been proven that would have been impossible without this collaboration between human and machine intelligence. Very little science, in fact, can be done without computers. Very few professionals can do their jobs altogether without machines. Every time we use a search engine, we're expanding our mental horizons and accessing this exponential growing knowledge base, which is a unique attribute of the human species. No other animal species has a knowledge base that they share down the generations. And the human knowledge base is growing exponentially. And that's putting increasing emphasis and reliance and responsibility on the educational industry and sector of society. And it is really our information technology that's going to enable us to meet that challenge. We'll have full immersion virtual reality from within the nervous system. We'll have these nanobots inside our bloodstream, keeping us healthy from inside, expanding our mental horizons by interacting with our biological neurons to continue this growth of exponential growth of information and knowledge and intelligence, which will continue this unique attribute and challenge of the human species. And I'll leave you with one other implication of these technologies. We are the species that goes beyond our limitations, and I believe we're not defined by our limitations. And that's not in a story. Human life expectancy was in the mid-20s when our genes evolved. It was not in the interest of the species for people to live, by and large, much past childrearing. That meant like age 25 or 26, and that was the post-infant mortality life expectancy 1,000 years ago. Post-infant mortality life expectancy in 1800 was 37. There was no sanitation, so people got bacterial infections, there were no antibiotics, so many of them were fatal, there were no social safety nets. Life is described well by Thomas Hobbes as short, brutish, labor-filled, disaster-prone, disease-filled. We've come a long way in just 200 years. 1900, human life expectancy was 48. This increase in life expectancy of really healthy aging, and actually eventually overcoming aging, will go into high gear as we get to the maturing of this biotechnology revolution, where we can literally reprogram the information processes that underlie biology. And according to my models, in 15 years, we'll be adding more than a year every year to your remaining life expectancy, not infant life expectancy. So as you go forward a year, your life expectancy will move on away from you. So if you can hang in there for another 15 years, we may get to experience the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.
Time to go to the break. It's in the exhibit area. See you there.